You're listening to the DC Real Estate Podcast, the podcast where we focus exclusively on all things local to the DMV area. Local investors, local knowledge, local experts. Our journey starts now.
Welcome to episode 2 of the DC Real Estate Podcast. My name is Russell Brazil. I am an associate real estate broker with Arla Real Estate.
I'm Jack Seiden. I am, introduced myself last week. I am a flipper, developer, do some rental properties in the DC area.
My name is Mark Maloof. I'm a hard money lender and commercial mortgage lender with Trias Lending. I'm also a licensed general contractor in DC and Maryland, a licensed real estate agent in Maryland, and a portfolio property manager for a condo association management company.
Mark does a little bit of everything.
That's the way I like it.
Jack of all trades.
Yep.
So this week we're going to be talking about mostly flips. We're going to try to stay on topic. Jack with DMV Flippers just picked up a flip maybe a month ago, I guess.
We're now deep into the thing, so we have some more, costs really.
Yeah, so let's talk about how did we find that deal.
So we bought it through a local wholesaler. It was actually an interesting story. So I had originally offered, I think, $450 on it, which was over list. They rejected the offer. They actually called me back a few days later and said, "Are you still interested?" And the original deal fell through. And at this point, it was kind of awkward because they knew I was willing to pay $450. This is a big thing about negotiation, but I knew they were calling me back because they didn't have a better offer or the offer had fallen apart. So I told them I was going to pay $430, and you kind of have what's called internal leverage. Like, that was the most I was going to pay. Regardless, they took it. So we ended up getting it. That was the original price, but for less than I had originally offered. We came in with sight unseen, which was always a risk. And the first time I saw it with Russell, he got there a few minutes early and he said, "Dude," and then the half second before he finished a sentence, I thought he was going to say, like, "What did you buy? This is awful." But it wasn't. We had just done a flip a couple blocks over. And so we knew the renovation budget pretty much to the number. And we are now at the point where I'm pretty confident about what the number is going to come in on. We've demoed the house, so we know all the problems. It's going to come in almost to the digit, exactly what I thought, which is about a 130 reno. So about 1,500 square feet. So that includes cosmetic, that includes, we're doing two bathrooms. One of the baths is a half bath. We're going to convert to a full. We do the full bath. It doesn't need all new systems. We need new plumbing. The HVAC is existing, which is good, but some of the HVAC has to be moved around to accommodate more open concept, move some walls. So that's a 130 reno. We paid 430. That puts us in at 560. I do not pay Mark's hard money
not
fees,
yet.
Fees. So our overhead on this should be about, I think, probably about $8,000 in interest, taxes, recordation, real estate fees. We're going to run about $70,000 in overhead. So we bought $430. We'll be in for $630. I think given where the market is, and the other day I was looking, there was one renovated row home of at least three baths west of the river for under $750. So I think we're getting $7 easily. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think $7 is going to be a pretty easy number to hit.
I think we might, depending on how hot the market continues to be, get $725. So we're going to clear between $80,000 and $100,000 on this deal. It's going to be a relatively quick project. I'm hoping we're going to get it done sometime mid-November. We picked it up mid-August, which is actually, you can do a three-month reno. That's pretty good.
I really think one of the keys to picking up this property, though, was the ability to buy it sight unseen.
Which
right?
Most people should not do. But
no. Most people should not. And we were able to do that because we had renovated in this neighborhood previously. We knew exactly what the reno costs were. And even if things went wrong, we could be off by $50,000 and still have been in the profit area, right?
So, and I did walk the perimeter. So one of the big things, and this is something, again, you have to know about, I knew what to look for. I knew if there was a big foundation problem, and a lot of the big stuff is outside. We looked at a flip a couple of days ago in that same neighborhood, and we looked at the retaining wall, and that was outside, and that was like $40,000. So, you know, once you're inside the house, let's say it could still be $130,000, right? But the unexpected costs, the things that drive your cost up, $40,000-$50,000 unexpectedly are either wood frame homes when the wood falls apart, or mostly stuff on the exterior foundation, retaining walls, things like that.
Well, Jack, talk about that for a second, right? Because you had a deal that you did, what, a year or two ago?
About two years now.
Yeah. So that was one that you actually walked through.
Yes.
Was that one that you had an inspection on?
So I don't usually do inspections because usually what they're going to tell you is this house is crap, but it's like, I know that. So, and this is actually a deal that's interesting that I would buy these numbers again. And this is kind of like the key to flipping. You don't make money on every house. So we bought it for $470. We got in the house. The floors were sloping.
Is this the Quackenboss house?
Yeah, the Quackenboss house.
If you're interested in looking at the renovation, the address is 124 Quackenboss Street Northwest.
That's it. I think that's it. Let me pull out my phone. This is riveting.
But if you're curious to see the kind of finishes we're putting in these flips.
That was really – we did a great job. And ironically, it's the house I was thinking – probably get a million. Yeah, 124. We'd probably get a million for it now. We probably shouldn't have sold it. I mean, like, there's some ones you sell and it's like, yeah, it's gone up. But that one, I feel like it's gone up the most over the least period of time.
Well, that's because what the consumer is looking for has changed with COVID,
yeah,
right? So that was a single family home in the city, which was not a particularly desirable asset 2 or 3 years ago. Today, a fully detached single family home with a huge yard is highly desirable in the city. Okay. So
the Redfin estimate is $1 million.
Yeah. So that's 124 Quackenboss Street Northwest. Really, really cool property. Check out the pictures on that.
So we bought it at 470. The floors were obviously sloping to the point that we got a foundation person in there. And for some reason, I just wasn't thinking termites. So we got the foundation person in there and he kind of just thought the foundation was fine, which was true. And kind of just thought that floor was just kind of giving out. Which I guess it was true in some sense, but it just, that house was eaten up by termites to every inch of it. I mean, it was basically, I would say 95% of the wood in that house is new. Now, we bought it for 470, we sold for 790. We lost about 50 grand on that deal. On the one hand, like, I don't really do wood frame deals anymore. I'm not exclusively, but I do like to stay away from them. On the other hand, that is like a deal, like, those are good numbers, and 99% of the time you make money on that. In fact, even if we had half of the wood frame damage, you probably would have broken even. And it's one of those deals where.
Well, and it's really unusual to find extensive termite damage in the city.
Yes.
We find it in the suburbs all the time where there's large yards with, you know, lots of food for a termite to eat, but we don't really run into that in the city that often. So that was sort of an unusual event. You came and visited that property, right, Mark?
I did. I was at the broker's open. And, you know, Jack, you talk about, you know, the renovation going really well and it turning out really nice. And, you know, one of the things I do, I can't help it, right? I've been in construction for a long time. And, you know, everywhere I go, I'm picking things apart, right? I look at every single detail, right? When I go to a restaurant, that's what I'm checking out. Fire code violations and tile that wasn't installed properly. It's a curse. But when I walked through your renovation, I have to say I was very, very impressed.
I appreciate
and
it.
The contractor that you use, you know, it's very obvious that he takes pride in what he does.
No, he's great.
And he really did a nice job for you. You know, and I look at details like slope of the dish tray, of the niche in the shower, you know, that's something that a lot
of
people miss.
Did you use the shower?
I plead the fifth.
So you would eat in that kitchen. It would be acceptable to you.
The kitchen was beautiful. I like you guys had to, you know, you kind of had to, for space requirements, you had to make some changes to the way the countertop was installed for you to get the clearance that you needed. So you guys got pretty creative with that. And, you know,
it was a great product. It was just, you like to make money, but
of course.
So have you, you've done some flips, right?
I have. I've done 4 flips. My specialty, for those that don't know, is condos, right? That's my bread and butter. I manage a bunch of condo associations in DC. I work for one of the largest management companies in the area. And so I know condos kind of like the back of my hand. That's what I really like to specialize in. Because I know it and because it scares a lot of other people off.
Yes.
And so.
Including me. Some of the condos you buy, I'm like, I don't know if
good.
I do it.
Don't buy them. So I'll talk for a second about the very first flip that I did. And, this one was really interesting. This was a situation where there was a power of attorney. The owner was in the hospital and we ended up settling on a price and, you know, decided that we were going to move forward. Everybody was on board. Well, come to find out through the title work that, the power of attorney was an outdated form. And, you know, this was my first deal. This was my first flip, my first real estate deal, aside from my primary residence. And I didn't know that much about it. Well, apparently when somebody dies, the power of attorney now is done, right? It's finished. It's no longer in effect. And to make a long story short, they had to go and revise the power of attorney, and we ended up purchasing the property on a Friday. The gentleman ended up passing away on Sunday. And so we just barely snuck in, you know, and being able to acquire this property. And, you know, fortunately his estate was able to get the, you know, the purchase price and what we offered. And, that was a fantastic deal. And this was, you know, one of the properties that, this was a condo association that was non-warrantable at the time. And, you know, we were able to turn it into a warrantable condominium, which really helped our sales price on the back end.
Do you want to explain what non-warrantable?
So let's talk about what that means for a second. So non-warrantable condos, that means that the, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will not lend on the condo association for any number of particular reasons. It could be too many homeowners are in late on their condo dues. There could be too many pending lawsuits against the association. But what happens is when a condo association becomes non-warrantable, the prices on them will plummet. So Mark was able to, through his expertise in managing HOAs and condo associations, was able to essentially turn this association from non-warrantable into warrantable, meaning Fannie Mae would now lend on them. And in doing so, because now the pool of available buyers would be so much bigger, he was able to raise the amount of buyers that would be there and thus raising demand on this association, thus pushing values on the on these condos up pretty dramatically, right?
Yeah, we raised property values about 20%, you know, over the course of the four flips that we did there, which, you know, made, I mean, people were thrilled. You know, they were calling me, you know, by the time we were doing the second one, they were calling me and saying, hey, there's this, my neighbor, you know, they're, I think they're behind or something, or, you know, I don't like the way that their unit looks, you know, can you buy that one and renovate it? You know, we were really knocking that out of the park for them. And they really hadn't seen anything like that in that particular association.
And can you walk through how you took it from non-warrantable to warrantable?
Yeah. So basically, without getting into too much detail, we were able to work with the delinquencies, get the delinquencies down to a level that was acceptable at the time. And I believe it's still the case. It's 15% delinquency ratio. And that's just the number of owners in the association that are 30, 60, and 90 days behind. And, you know, we didn't have an issue at the time with the rental ratio. And that's a big one for financing. You know, usually when you get above a 50% rental ratio, and what that means is the ratio of owner occupants to investors. When you get above a 50% rental ratio, meaning more than 50% are investor owned units, that can cause problems for financing. Not always, but a lot of the times it can. And, you know, we have seen some loosening of those restrictions actually with FHA. What, Russell, you probably know this better than I do, in the last year or two.
Yeah, I think they dropped it down from 50 to maybe 35%, something like that.
Yep,
and to be clear, you can still get a conventional loan on these, just not the FHA.
I think previously it had to be 50% for conventional, and now it's 35%, I think.
No, but when it's non-warrantable, can you get a loan with 20% down from a bank, or is it because Fannie and Freddie won't buy them back?
Well, no one's going to issue the loan if Freddie and Fannie don't buy the loans.
You can get portfolio, is that correct?
So it's very difficult to find a portfolio lender who will do an investment property on a investment loan on a non-warrantable. There are some banks that will do owner-occupied. That's much more common, but the doing an investor loan on non-warrantable is kind of like a, you know, a unicorn. Like,
so how did you get the delinquencies down? Did you just get people who were behind to pay? Was there evictions? What was it? Was there liens placed? How did you actually get people to pay their back?
Yep. So we worked with the condo association to, you know, put people that had not previously been in collections into collections. You know, through the small act of doing that, you know, we were able to get a bunch of people that, you know, there was really no reason for them to pay. If there was no penalty, then, you know, folks aren't really incentivized to pay sometimes. You know, those of us who like to have our names clear and, you know, pay our bills on time probably think a little bit differently, but there's folks out there who just try to get away with anything they can. And so if there are no penalties, then a lot of times they just won't pay. So by sending them to collections, that, you know, kind of motivated them a little bit more to, you know, to pay their bills. We were able to bring the delinquencies down that way. We also paid off the delinquency of the unit that we purchased, which helped a little bit as well. And through all that, we were able to get them down under 15%. And basically turned, and we were close. I mean, you know, it's not like we were at a 40% delinquency ratio. You know, we were, I think 18 or 19 or something.
So is that something you look for when you invest, is that it's within some manageable range?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not – so it's sometimes a little bit difficult to get that information. Sometimes you have to pay to have a condominium questionnaire filled out by the management company. You know, that can cost you $50, $100, $150 depending on the management company.
Not a big deal.
Well, depends. For some people, they don't want to spend the, yeah, you know, the money up front. But there are ways of finding that out. Now, in terms of actually being able to reach the board and, you know, put those effects into place, that can be a little bit trickier. But that's one of the things that, again, I kind of like that, you know, if you can get in touch with somebody on the board and you can say, look, this is what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to help you out in this manner. This is how it's going to benefit you and all your residents. Really, the primary purpose behind an HOA or a condominium association, as much as, you know, a lot of people like to hate on them. And, you know, personally, I would never live in one, even though I manage one, I manage them. I would never live in one. For a lot of these same reasons, but the primary purpose of them is to maintain, preserve, and enhance the value of the association, right, and of all the units, right?
Exactly.
And so if you can show people a lot of times how you can do that and increase their property values, they're usually pretty happy.
So we were talking about this in the last episode about kind of these older aging condos as they age and the HOA fees go up. Do you think we're going to see some of these older buildings that are now 50, 60, 70 years old as they age, we're going to see, and the HOA fees go up, we're going to see higher and higher delinquency rates in some of these older buildings? Do you think that's going to be a trend over the next few years?
You know, a lot of the buildings that we manage at the company I work for are over 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of maintenance that these properties, right, need just on a yearly basis, yeah, and on a monthly basis. So I think that's something that's been around for some time now. I do think that, you know, there are certainly situations where, you know, condominium associations underfund themselves, and it creates a big problem in terms of having enough money on hand, you know, not only having enough money, but planning for that money in advance, right, when these capital components need to be replaced,
right,
like the roof, like the tuck pointing between the bricks, you know, like the
reserve studies.
Exactly. I mean, the reserve studies are critical, you know, and it's I'm glad you brought that up. Because the reserve study is one of the primary things that I look at when determining whether an association is financially viable, right? Mm-hmm. And these are things that you don't have to worry about if you're buying a single family house.
Correct.
And for the most part, not really if you're buying a townhouse, right? It doesn't, correct, affect you quite as much because you're responsible for a lot more of that home, you know, yourself. Yep. But the reserve study, for those of you who don't know what a reserve study is, it's basically a document. It's a compilation of all the capital components of a building or of an association. So it would be, let's say we're talking about a building, it would be the roof, it would be, you know, the tuck pointing, it would be all the common area mailboxes, light fixtures, anything that is a common element gets factored into the reserve study. And the whole purpose of the reserve study is to help an association plan for their reserve contributions, right? So every year the association puts together an operating budget. And it includes things like utilities, insurance, management fees, repairs and maintenance. And there's a line item called contributions to reserve, or reserve, you know, reserve contributions. And that those funds basically cover replacement of all the capital components. And if there's a huge discrepancy between what the reserve study calls for and what the budget says should be contributed annually, that's a red flag. And that is something that people should heed and be careful of. That doesn't mean that special assessments are coming, but it's one thing to add to your toolbox to make sure that, you know, you're doing all your due diligence and, you know, you're properly evaluating the health of this association, the financial health.
So this particular association that you'd done this on, one of the really cool things was not only doing the renovation, but, so getting it from non-warrantable to warrantable. So not only were you able to make profit for yourself, but you're able to actually help out everyone in that association by helping them raise their values, which is super cool. When we go back and talk about some of the renovations that you did on that, what did the numbers on that look like?
Yeah, so that very first one we bought for $55,000. Yeah,
it's practically free.
Yeah, you won't find those anymore down there. This one was out in Hyattsville.
Oh, that's actually not even so bad. It's not like...
No, and this was probably 3 or 4 years ago. Okay. You know, now they're a little bit more expensive, but the first one we picked up for 55, put about, if I remember correctly, about 32 into it, sold it for 160.
So, and what were your other like overhead on an 80, so 87, what were your other costs?
So we just had the condo fees that we paid every month. We had the insurance costs.
Was this a cash deal?
It was a cash deal. Yeah.
Cash
it
deal.
Was, it was
so all, you probably ran what, 30 in taxes and liquidation and real estate fees?
25
is cheaper.
I don't remember.
So it was probably a good 50 grand profit on a 50 grand
purchase. Yeah, it was about 42, if I remember correctly, okay. 42, somewhere between 42 and 44.
On a 55 grand purchase price, that's
pretty good. I mean, that's phenomenal, right? That's phenomenal. I mean, I would take those all day long.
Right. I might make 50 or 60, but on a 500 grand purchase price.
Exactly, right? So, you know, that's one of the main reasons I like condos. Yeah. You know, this is something that I'm building from the ground up. I'm not a trust fund baby. I don't have, right. you know, millions and millions of dollars just sitting there waiting to be deployed. I'm building this thing from the ground up. And so, mm-hmm. you know, for me getting into this, I really didn't have a choice mm-hmm. but to get into condos. And now I've just gotten to the point to where I like them so much that, and I know them so well that it's, you know, why.
And do you think deals like that are still out there, or is that, has the market on that shifted?
I think deals are out there. I think they're becoming harder and harder to find. But the deals are definitely out there. And, you know, I think it's a little bit harder to do some of your due diligence on a condo than, you know, maybe it is on a single family house or a townhouse, mm-hmm. just because it's a little bit harder to get that information Correct. That you really want.
Well, that's where the idea of a competitive advantage comes in, right? So you have a ton of experience managing condo associations. So you have a very specific competitive advantage in that little niche that you're able to recognize, even just the idea that you could take it from non-warrantable and raise the value by making it warrantable. So not only were you able to renovate to improve the value, but you're able to change the circumstances of the building to improve the value. Right. And so we talked about this a little bit last week with 2 weeks ago with Jack. His competitive advantage here in flipping is that we're able to do it with all cash, right? Because it's when you're talking about a $500,000-$700,000 property, very hard to do with hard money today with the rates and the fees.
I'm supposed to throw Mark under the bus.
Yeah.
That's okay. Sorry, I do primarily commercial mortgages these days, so that's okay. I'm all right with that.
You know, that's been Jack's competitive advantage in flipping. So all of us have competitive advantages, whether we realize it or not. It's a matter of being able to recognize what those things are and how to exploit those so that we can get out there and make profit.
Right.
Yeah, because Jack, I mean, talk to us for a second. I mean, if you had to go hard money, right? I mean, you're making, like, what would you say your average profit on one of your flips is?
It varies wildly. So average is hard. I would say generally like to make 50, 60, but sometimes you lose money. I've made 100, right? So I think 50, 60 is probably a good number.
So you'd probably end up with what, about 20 by the time it's all said and done?
If you did hard money? I can calculate this. So what right now, what is your hard money rate? Like 8%?
Somewhere between 9 and 12. It depends on the borrower and the deal.
So let's say use 10% because that's easy to calculate.
So yeah. It'd be
a couple of points in fees?
Yep. So let's say 600,000 times 10 is 60. Let's say it's 30. How many points are you generally charging?
Factor in 2.
12. You got like 45 grand. So yeah, it goes from making 60 to making 15. And 15 is, if you're at that danger of a number, don't do the deal, right? I mean, at that point, it's.
So the flip we're doing in Brentwood, we'll probably make 100 on it.
Yeah,
literally take away 50% of the profit.
Right. But that deal is a good deal, right? Most deals you're looking at are 50 or 60.
Most deals aren't that good.
And then maybe you make 10, 15. I mean, I talked to a hard money lender once. Not you, but someone else who said his average client makes 10 grand on a flip, which is like, okay, that's a hobby. I mean, that's a.
Well, if he's doing them 10 a year, it's a living.
Maybe, but that's also, I don't think you could find 10.
And assuming he's actually making the 10 and not running into unforeseen issues like. Yeah. Right.
I mean, 10 is just such a small number. And also, I don't think there are 10 deals out there. I think you'd struggle to do the volume, right? One of the things we focus on right now, we do less deals and we try to make. I'm actually very picky about the deals I pick because I don't want to be using the hard money because it's expensive. So I have a certain amount of working capital, probably can do about 2 at a time. So I often will, if there's a deal I'm going to make 30 on, I'll often say no because I want to hold that money open for the 50, 60 grand deal. So we actually try to do less volume and more and hold that capital open so that when a home run comes, we can take it.
And that's a strategy that works well right now. If we were 5 years ago where deals were much more prevalent, then we'd want to leverage a lot more. But we simply can't find deals right now. DC Urban Turf reported in an article a few months ago that flipping activity was down about 75% in DC year over year. So that's if, you know, 2 years ago, if there was, you know, 10 flips, now there's two, maybe three of them. They're just very hard to come by right now.
I will say they're still very hard to come by, but I have noticed anecdotally, it does seem like, so the selling for the done stuff is as hot as it's ever been. Does seem like the stuff that, you know, a couple months ago, the stuff that needed work was still flying off the shelves.
Yep.
It seems like that has slowed a little bit. There's a lot of stuff I have favorited that needs work and is sitting a little bit. And I do wonder if what has happened now is that enough people have left the market and or hard money's gotten more expensive that there is potentially over the next year or two going to be a little bit expanded of margins. They contracted. I also wonder if, you know, the prices have gone up so much, just simply 10% of $300,000 is way less than 10% of $600,000, which sounds obvious, but there is a point at which the prices in DC have gone so much that people can't afford to flip in a way. Yeah. But
well, the margins have definitely been squeezing. And so, you know, a lot of flippers in other parts of the country or even in ours talk about this idea of the 70% rule. Sometimes in Maryland and DC, people throw out the 65% rule. We don't look at a percentage at all. We look at gross margin. What is the price that we can buy the property for and sell it for? And if it's a relatively easy flip, we know what our cost to renovate are. So we're mostly looking at what that gross margin is. And that gross margin has been consistently shrinking over the last few years, but really shrunk even more so during COVID.
And that 70%, what I want to say, is the dumbest rule in real estate. No one should follow it. The obvious example I use is if you buy a house for $70,000, that's a complete gut job and it's worth $100,000 done. You would lose tens of thousands of dollars. The problem that people don't realize, most costs and even market to market are relatively fixed, right? A roof, the difference between Baltimore and DC might be a few grand, but the most of the stuff is the, you know, there's a baseline level to doing a renovation, right? So like, a renovation, a DC row home might cost me $130. I go to Baltimore and do it for $100. But that's, you know, only $30,000. That the and people also have this problem where they think, oh,
that's more than your house costs in Baltimore.
That's true. Well, no, but you see, actually, that's a good example because you see people who will say, I have this $10,000 deal in Baltimore and it's worth $50, and you know, that's five times. But that the cost of a renovation is fixed, right? Your plumbing doesn't change based on the cost of your house. So when people look at the 70% rule, it implies that all of your costs, the HVAC, the plumbing, the countertops, all of that is mostly fixed. Maybe some of the finishes can get less, but the price point you buy it at has no bearing on the actual cost of the labor. People don't think of it that way.
Well, it's funny too, because we mentioned Baltimore and, you know, there's literally houses in Baltimore where the acquisition costs plus the renovation costs and
$50,000 underwater.
Yeah, it's amazing. So I was just trying to sell this flip for a friend of mine that's in another part of the country. He was a hard money lender. He was lending on this flip, and I think the acquisition cost was something like $30,000. And you always think, how can you lose the money on a $30,000 property?
This is in Baltimore?
This is in Baltimore.
Where else would you get a property for $30,000?
A lot of places in the Midwest, actually.
Well, I guess Midwest, yeah. Chicago.
He was stuck in this property for like 4 years. Still can't sell it. It's been rehabbed twice because the first time was so bad that they couldn't get the use and occupancy permit after, so they rehab it again. It's still a terrible renovation. And the cost of renovating it properly, plus how much he's got into it, would be less than the actual property's worth. It's just kind of dumbfounding. But there are people out there right now in DC and in Baltimore that are buying properties that are paying X, you know, I'm going to make up numbers here. They're buying a property for $500. They're putting $150 into it for $650, and it's only worth $600 at the end. And we see that time and time and time again. And it's one of the reasons we can't find deals to flip because people are overpaying for these properties so dramatically.
And let's talk for a second about why that is. I mean, for me, this all started really when all the flipping shows came out on HGTV, right? And they saw all these numbers that these shows completely made up. Don't account for holding costs or
something. Well, it's actually a bathroom. It's like $2,000. Okay, it's not $2,000. It's like never. Seven.
You can never trust those numbers. But I think it spurred a lot of people into thinking that you can make these massive profits with just a little bit of work. And so I think people are now just you know, running with that.
But the other thing that I often think too, and this isn't actually so much, it's such an interesting thing kind of to go to burying and stuff. And I feel this way too. There's a lot of times like I want to do a flip And I'm like, this isn't a good deal. I'll make a little bit of money, but like, it's fun, right? I do think people underestimate that. Like the thing about, like, I've always thinks about burrowing. Like right now, there are very few deals you can make money burrowing. Basically, you're lucky if you, so you can find a deal that's worth four, you put 100 into it, you cash out for five, but you could just buy a renovated home for five and have the rental income right away. Like a lot of the burrs right now, you're getting back to, you're not getting any equity in it and you've lost 6 months of rental income. And it's like, but that's definitely more fun, right? Than just buying a turnkey thing. I think it's also like people enjoy it.
I love the renovation.
I love doing it. It's awesome. It's fun. Right? Exactly.
It's my favorite part. I will never buy a turnkey property.
Exactly.
Never.
Exactly. But you'll be underwater too, and you'll still, it'll be worth it, right?
I would never buy a property that I was underwater on.
But unless, I'm the opposite. I want to buy already renovated. I don't want to deal with that bullshit.
Which is a fantastic point in the different investors' criteria, right? And so it's in helping people figure out what they want to do and what their risk tolerance is. You know, when you buy a turnkey property, there's not a whole lot you have to do. What, you clean it up, you get it ready for the renter, and you list it, right?
And after the tenants move out, because it's been renovated fairly recently, then I'm talking about only needing to do paint touch-up on a turnover. So maid service and paint touch-up, and then I'm good to go. And basically 2 days after someone moves out.
It's funny, though. I feel like I'm the different. I love flipping. I love doing that. I have a great passion for it. There are times where I probably take deals I shouldn't take just because, like, I enjoy doing it. But I actually agree with Russell on the rental properties. I wouldn't burr. I mean, it depends on the deal, right? If there was a great deal, I'd burr it. But like for the most part, like I just want to get a tenant in there and get my check. I don't want to sit and wait 6 months.
And let's clarify, when you say burr, you're talking about the acronym BRRR. Buy, yeah. renovate, rehab, repeat. Rent. Yes.
But refinance, I don't think refinance, repeat. But I think the goal, a couple of years ago, you could get equity, right? You could get basically end up kind of with a free house. But now I don't know that they exist, or there's enough equity to get your equity out after the renovation. Even if you can, then you're underwater on the cash flow, right?
Well, let me come over to the dark side and let me talk to you about some of these condos I bought.
Okay. So the condos are a little bit different, but.
So the first condo I bought, I picked it up for $45,000. Mm-hmm. This is in Southeast DC. $45,000, including a standalone individual bay parking garage, like you'd find in a townhouse, right?
That's actually really nice. I didn't know they had those out.
They do. Yeah. So $45,000, I put about a little bit less than $25,000 into it. Ended up cashing out $75,000. So mm-hmm. I was already in the black $5,000, and I was cash flowing about $3.25 a month on mm-hmm. that one. Ended up buying the one across the hall. I paid $29,000 for that one. Put about $30,000 into it, and I cashed out a little over $90,000 on that one.
And what were we cash flowing on them after you were done?
Both of them are a little over $3,000.
Send me them next time.
$300 each. One of them you got $5,000 more than you put into it out of it, and the other one you got $30,000 more than you. So not only do you have these two assets that are cash flowing $300 a month each, but you've also made $35,000
yes.
extra, mm-hmm. Which is not taxable because it is a loan.
Yep.
So you get all that principal back on both of them plus an extra $35,000.
That's not a bad deal.
That's pretty good.
If you can find them, you should do that. But
and both of them, how long have you owned them now?
The one I've owned about 2 years, maybe 2.5 years. The other one about 2 years.
I would say. Both pre-COVID.
Yep.
So, and maybe those will start coming back.
But I'm also in a market where I think COVID probably didn't have a drastic impact. And actually, the one that I rented this last time, I rented it right in the middle of COVID.
Yeah, well, that price point, you kind of have nowhere to go but up.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're not going to lose on any of those deals. You know, and they're out there, right? It's just a matter of finding them.
But I do think, to get back to like post-COVID, again, we all enjoy this. It's sexy. But like, I do think people just underestimate. We talk about this all the time. Just because I think people sometimes complicate things. Buy something that's rent-ready, move-in ready. Frankly, I think this is something me and Russell agree on, but a lot of people are not going to agree with. Even if it's cash flow neutral, you buy it. It's not as exciting as you make your money in 6 months, but you can know in the DC market, if you buy a good property in an appreciated neighborhood, in 5, 6, 7 years, you're going to make $100,000. You can do it turnkey, and like that's where the money is now, I think.
Yeah, see, there's no right straight dopamine hit when you're buying a rent-ready property, and it's like, you know, you got to deal with all the crap of being a landlord,
and
right? Which isn't terribly hard, but
you know, it's more annoying than it is the money. It's just like a pain.
But what happens is after 5 years, you're like, Jesus, that property's up $100,000 if it's in the suburbs, $200,000 if it's in the city, and that's when you get the dopamine hit. It's 5 years down the line. It's not immediate like it is with a flip.
And what's your saying? Because I think this is true about like the cash flow makes you money and the
cash flow. Yeah, cash flow is how I pay my bills. But appreciation is how I build wealth.
Like, I will buy deals all day long if I think it's in a hot neighborhood where I'm breaking even on the rent, which I know is like not popular. But like, it's just in the DC. I don't know if this is true for other cities. I feel like it's actually pretty easy to figure out gentrification lines. Right now, we're moving DC east to north and east of the city.
DC, it has been extremely linear, right? It started in Chinatown when we were probably kids, right? And just along Georgia Ave. It went east along H Street. It's going east along New York Ave and Rhode Island Ave now. It's probably the easiest thing you can do to buy in the path of progress in DC.
So, like right now, I think we're probably DC is starting to literally gentrify out. So I think the next areas are going to be Route 1, PG County, and then Georgia Avenue from Montgomery.
County. Yeah, Route 1 and along College Park is
incredible these days.
Yeah, it's night and day compared to what it was 5 or 10 years ago.
What it was 2 years ago. I think Prince George's County has just exploded in the last year or two.
Well, people have gotten priced out of Montgomery County, right? And they've moved that direction. But all that development along Route 1 is just – it's unbelievable. Every block, there's a new building going up.
And then I think Montgomery County, I still think will gentrify north on Georgia Ave, Silver Spring, Wheaton, up into
probably
the next thing.
I mean, I love that Georgia Ave corridor in Silver Spring and Wheaton. You're close to the metro. You're close to the city.
Spring is like, every time I'm there, I'm like, this is a lot better than a lot of the gentrifying DC neighborhoods as far as entertainment. Like, it's like, cause like, it's funny, like Silver Spring is always like less than like Brightwood or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's way more going on there.
Well, yeah, Brightwood and Petworth and, like 16th Street Heights, there's nothing there.
Right. Silver Spring, at least there's movies, there's entertainment, there's, but I don't know what, restaurants, bars. Do you have any flips potentially you're looking at or?
No, I mean, if I came across one, I actually talked to a wholesaler about one just the other day. He brought it to me and, we were hoping to get it for a certain price and, the seller wasn't willing to go that low just yet. So maybe that's something that will materialize down the road. But I tell you, man, I did my flips and, you talk about the dopamine hit. I mean, that instant gratification, I mean, I just love it. I really can't get enough of it, but from a tax perspective, it makes so much more sense to burr. And to just keep these properties, especially like you guys were just talking about, if you can buy them in areas that you know are going to appreciate,
right.
It's just a matter of time before all this gentrification that we're seeing, all this development that we're seeing on the one side of the river, on the west side, moves to the east side.
Well, I think today, actually, didn't they open the Frederick Douglass Bridge, which is going to connect Navy Yard.
People posting it on Instagram pictures the other day of walking across it. So I think they had some big event.
So that essentially, changes everything in Anacostia because now you can walk to Navy Yard. I mean, there's not – literally it takes away a geographical barrier.
Well, Anacostia has been hot the last 5-6 years. Yeah, it's been the fastest appreciating on a percentage basis neighborhood, I think, 5 years straight in D.C. Now, part of that is 5-6 years ago, the average price there was probably – I'm sort of guessing here, but probably about 200,000. Today it's probably about 400,000.
Now, but let me ask you your opinion on this. If now they're connected, Anacostia is on the water. Could you see in a decade that waterfront getting redeveloped on that side? And okay, Anacostia is $1 million. I mean, probably not 5 years, but could you see that waterfront eventually being redeveloped and that becoming?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that side of the river is always going to trail the west side in terms of pricing, but tons of people buying houses there. People are renovating them. It's sort of the big caveat will be, so the people that are crossing the river now to buy, something needs to happen that renters cross the river to rent over there.
You think it's the walkability to Navy Yard? Do you think that
could be? That definitely could help. Obviously having Navy Yard and the stadium there are, quite useful. The ability to get across that bridge now, being walkable is certainly going to help. And the redevelopment of Berry Farm projects is going to happen at some point, right? And that's just been, sort of a sore spot over there. And that's once that happens, that'll probably be a big driver for the neighborhood. But if you go further east from there, further east and north, like the Deanwood neighborhood is
that's one white
hot. Not as much commercial development over there, but like. I think you get good value over there for the money you pay. It's not quite as expensive as Anacostia, and it's still appreciating quite well.
The other thing is a lot of people think of Southeast as like crime ridden, but there's plenty of neighborhoods like Benning Ridge. I'm trying to think of them. Like Hillcrest.
Hillcrest is a nice neighborhood.
It's always been the nice part
but that's of that part expensive. Of the city. But I'm saying you can go to Benning Ridge, which is like a very nice, safe area and get something for Ford, row home. Like, they're still cheap on that side of the river, and you don't have to necessarily deal with the crime. So I do think there's probably potential there.
Jack, talk for a second. You know, we were talking earlier about wholesalers and you getting this last deal from a wholesaler. Talk a little bit about, you know, how many deals you've purchased from wholesalers, what your experience has been. Because I know a lot of times you run into wholesalers that have no clue what they're doing. They're trying to make a fast buck. They think they can, you know, just assign these deals without spending a whole lot of money. And, you know, their numbers are off. They're unethical. Tell us about your experiences with wholesalers, man.
Yes. I have bought one deal from a wholesaler. Every other deal I've bought has been off the MLS. For the most part, the wholesalers I have found are more expensive than I can find someone off the MLS for. The wholesaling as a whole is not good. You know, I'll be honest. I do have like, you know, my philosophy, which maybe is line or so, I will buy a wholesale deal once it's under contract because I feel like, okay, someone's going to buy it. It may as well be me. I don't think the ethics of wholesaling are great. I think to the extent that you're doing it, you're usually making money by stripping of someone else. Now, again, my philosophy has always been, once the deal is signed, someone's going to buy it. It may as well be me. But I actually don't think the wholesaling is a great thing for the real estate community because I think it's by definition exploitative. And yeah, the wholesaling, I usually don't buy from wholesalers. They tend to be, they're just more expensive. The wholesaler you bought it from has a decent reputation, and I think they're, you know, they were decent to deal with. A lot of the people there are not the type of people that I would want to be doing deals with, right? And I think you run into some ethical problems. You run into
well, you want to talk about that. We don't have to mention my name, but that wholesaler we ran into, we went to look at the property, and the price had been raised $50,000.
Was that? There was one property we went at. it was during COVID. And I'm not going to name the name, but it was actually a licensed realtor. So I think this is probably illegal. Yes. What was going on there?
I have no idea the specifics of what was going on. I just know it seemed very shady.
There was too many people there. It was during COVID and we get in there and the guy says, you should stay away from me. I just tested positive for COVID.
Oh, wait, that's a different property.
I was like, well, we shouldn't be in here. He's like, this is in the height. This is like in November, December. He's like, I tested positive. Oh, and that was there was some guy in the street who we were pretty convinced was going to pull a gun. He didn't, but we were sitting there and the guy's like,
I'm talking about that other one where we showed up. I forget what the exact prices were, but I'm going to say,
which one is this?
It was advertised as, say, 600. We get there and it's 650. And we're like, hey, why is the price?
Which one is this?
And the guy was like, well, the homeowner found out how much we were advertising it for.
Yeah. And the guy, I know what you're talking about. And the way he told us, this is someone, I'm not going to name his name, but I should. This is probably the worst, would you say the worst wholesale in the DC region?
The most unethical.
And he's complaining like this person, like we had to raise it because we had lied to her. Like she was the victim. I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure you're the victim here. The victimizing them. She's like, we told them we were buying it and we were, dishonest about it. And she like made us go up in price. Like he was the victim. I'm like, no, I think you're the one at fault here.
And we had another run in with that wholesaler with our friend, our friend was trying to buy this property and he was very honest with the homeowner that he was going to flip it and comes to find out she decides to go with this other potential buyer because he promised that he was going to live in the house with his family and renovate it and it was going to be their dream home. Well, when the deed finally gets recorded, we see who bought it and it was this wholesaler. And we're like, that douchebag ain't going to live in the property.
You know, it's funny. I bought a deal once. It wasn't a wholesale. We did close on it. I think we ended up wholetailing it off market. And the thing was like, we paid them less than it was market value, but we were very honest with them. We said, this is what you can get on market.
The Bethesda condo?
Yeah, I said, this is what you can get on market. This is the number that I need to make it work. We can close in cash. And it wasn't a wholesale. You know, we were the end buyer, but like, this is the number we have. She said, well, we think we can get more in the open market. And we said, that is true. We didn't lie. We said, we're going to.
Well, what was really interesting was you made him the offer. And then we said, and, you know, Russell's a realtor. If you want to list the property instead. And I said, yeah, I would probably list it at this. And I think the number I gave him was something like $80,000 more than what you offered him.
Yeah.
And he'd still decided to take that cash offer.
But in that case, it was like, you know, we didn't take advantage of him. He knew it. We later learned when he was closing, his mother was moving to nursing home. He lived in California. And they lived at a
He had to leave RV. Town with them
like
a few
an
days.
RV, yeah. And he didn't have time for it. And this was at the time a condo that was like, would probably take him 6 months to sell. I mean, it was a slow moving unit. And so.
But we're very honest. This was the price that you could pay. And this is the price that Russell could list it at. Two drastically different prices. And he still took the cheap.
All cash one. And then I think, so that's a good way. And I think, in fact, I think he probably took the offer in part because I think we were honest with him. And that was like a good situation where you were honest. And I think in some ways, for certain buyers, I think it may have helped close the deal that he felt like I wasn't taking advantage of him. There were other offers that I know he had in, and I was straight up with him.
So two great points on this exact situation, right? On this example. First one is you guys were upfront with him, right? Yeah. And that's something we don't see from a lot of wholesalers. And I'm not bashing wholesalers, right? Because there's at this point there is still a need for wholesalers. There is a market there for them, and there are guys who are doing this on the up and up.
There are
They are few. They are few and far between. But they do exist. Okay. Yes. So I'm not generalizing wholesalers, but generally there are more bad ones than good ones. 100%. Anyway, the other part of it is motivation, right? You know, people just getting into the real estate industry might think, well, why would this guy take a deal $80,000 less? How could you possibly be honest with him? And really, his motivation was, we don't know, right? We're speculating.
Actually, I do know. We talked about closing.
Well, tell us.
First of all, so it wasn't really 80 because he would have had to pay 6%. The HOA fees were like $1,000 a month. It was probably a net of like 40 or 50, we calculated.
Right,
But the time, having to deal with a realtor, time
value.
I think the biggest thing was that he didn't live here. He lived in California. And so I think the condo we saw, and this is all interesting, I think it was his mom's or something, or I don't know the details, but it had been purchased for like, I don't know, 120, 130. So he was still walking away with $300,000 in equity. And I guess, I know people's financial situations, right? Like, I always think that's a lot of money. If I had a parent or grandparent who lived halfway across the country, I might do that, right? There is like, once you hit a certain amount of money, the difference between $300 and $350, if you live halfway across the country, you don't want to deal with it. There are situations where your time is more valuable. I think he just, frankly, it was a burden for him. He didn't want to deal with it.
That was a great, though, simple little project. So we bought that off the Craigslist, basically.
Yes.
Did a little bit of cleanup.
Yep.
Threw it on the MLS and not a huge amount of profit.
About 10.
10 or 15 grand.
But yeah. But it wasn't like – it was no risk. We didn't do a renovation. We knew we weren't going to lose money. We kind of knew – it was actually one of those projects. We knew we weren't going to kill it. Although we did have – didn't we have some offer that was like 30 grand and with the last minute we pulled out, we were going to make 30 in like a week? Didn't we have some guy who was about to
– Yeah, there was an agent who screwed us.
Yes, that was unfortunate.
Yeah. But like Mark was saying, the fact that we were honest certainly – because he had talked to other wholesalers and he sold it to us.
Right.
And, his motivation was not getting top dollar.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, his particular motivation was maybe he had to move. He lived across – not move, but, he had to sell
the place.
Being
quick was his motivation.
Exactly. So just because somebody else is willing to offer more money does not necessarily mean that you will miss out on a deal.
And
let me just add this real quick. Listening to people, right? Yeah. I mean, you guys had enough of a conversation with this guy to understand what his situation was. It wasn't just, this is the house, here's what we can offer. It was listening to him. It was, what do you need out of this? What would make you happy? And then fulfilling that.
It was actually more than that. So we left, we had offered him, I think it was 330. And he said, there's no way I'm going to take that. And, it's just not going to happen. And I said, okay. I said, best of luck. Hope you sell it. I think I said at that point, if you need a realtor, it's Russell. I said, that's fine. Best of luck. I shook his hand and left. And the next morning he called me back. So we do 340. I said, yes. Like literally we had left and we thought we were 70 grand apart. And then next morning he called me and he's like, can we do 340? I'm like, we'll do 340.
And that comes from not trying to strong arm someone in negotiations. We were just being very honest. This is what we could pay. And literally the next morning he calls us back.
And that's also like a little bit of, not that's not why I did it, but like it's a little bit of leverage, right? Like we didn't make it seem like we were desperate. I was like, that's the number. If it doesn't work for you, that's great. Good luck. And that was a good example of just sometimes you can both be honest and make money, I guess.
Anyways, we're here at the 50-minute mark, so I think it's time to wrap up. If you guys are looking for some hard money, make sure to reach out to Mark.
Do you have any flips that you would like me to make you an offer on and be honest with you? You're welcome to reach out to me.
If you need to buy or sell a property, whether it's in your primary residence or if it's an investment property, reach out to me. You can reach all of us at info@dcrealestatepodcast.com.
Thanks for listening to the DC Real Estate Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to contact the hosts, reach out to them at info@dcrealestatepodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you access your podcasts.